The Broad Perspective Network is not responsible for the content of the following program.
Good morning. Welcome to The Broad Perspective on The Broad Perspective Network. We're glad you're with us today. I'm Vivian Camori.
I'm Ronnie DiGiovanni.
And we're going to be joined in just a little bit after our first break by Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell. And she's author of a book. It's an interesting topic today. It's, I guess, a little morose, maybe, or maybe not. I guess it's Making Peace with Suicide, a book of hope, understanding, and comfort.
That'll be an interesting topic.
Yeah, it will be an interesting topic, and it's probably not one that's discussed quite a lot.
And we're moving into the holidays, which could be a time when a lot of people are contemplating and depression hits a little bit more, too.
It can be a very depressive time, and you would know that, Dr. Ronnie.
Yeah. Well,
it's a subject that a lot of people don't want to talk about. It's not easily broached.
Yeah, I think it's in every one of our histories or family story somewhere.
Right. I concur. So she's going to join us in a little bit. In the meantime, getting back to our tradition of the Osho Zen Tarot, Ronnie drew the control card. And what is it? Something of cloud. It's a cloud card.
King of clouds.
King of clouds. Oh, yeah. The king would be in control.
Mastery of mind.
Ooh. Okay. Well, why don't you tell us what Osho has to say about that, Ronnie?
All right, the commentary. There is a time and a place for control, but if we put it in charge of our lives, we end up totally rigid. The figure is encased in the angles of pyramid shapes that surround him. Light glitters and glints off his shiny surfaces, but does not penetrate. It's as if he is almost mummified inside this structure he's built up around himself. His fists are clenched and his stare is blank, almost blind. The lower part of his body beneath the table is a knife point, a cutting edge that divides and separates. His world is ordered and perfect, but it is not alive. He cannot allow any spontaneity or vulnerability to enter it. The image of the King of Clouds reminds us to take a deep breath, loosen our neckties, and take it easy. If mistakes happen, it's okay. If things get a little out of hand, it's probably just what the doctor ordered. There is much, much more to life than being on top of things.
Okay, I think I need to study that page.
Well, how many of us are all into control and thinking we actually have some control?
You know, isn't that the truth? My husband and I watched a movie yesterday called Frequency. And it's a British film, and we recorded it because I can tell you we need to watch it again. It was very, very thought-provoking. And we really, the bottom line in the movie is we really don't have as much control as we think we do. We spend a lot of time spinning our wheels in that effort to control.
Well, I love the point when you realize you're trying to control it and there is no control of it, whatever it may
is.
Be.
That's true. And don't we spend a lot of time trying, like Osho says, trying to be on top of things? I know I'm guilty of that. I'm very much a do-it-now sort of person. I suppose I am a control freak in many ways. So it's something that I need to really take to heart, what Osho's saying there.
Well, yeah, take to heart, but gosh, you know, some of those patterns are so ingrained in us. And the fact is that I don't like feeling vulnerable.
Exactly.
And it feels like everything's spinning out of, and sometimes we just want just something that says, okay, I have some say, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's even a quote in the book, it says, life does life. And I'm like, ugh.
Exactly right. That's exactly what it does. Go ahead and read the second part, Ronnie.
All right. Controlled persons are always nervous because deep down turmoil is still hidden. If you are uncontrolled, flowing, alive, then you are not nervous. There is no question of being nervous. Whatsoever happens, happens. You have no expectations for the future. You are not performing. Then why should you be nervous? To control that mind, one has to remain so cold and frozen that no life energy is allowed to move into your limbs, into your body. If energy is allowed to move, those repressions will surface. That's why people have learned how to be cold, how to touch others and yet not touch them, how to see people and yet not see them. People live with cliches, hello, how are you? Nobody means anything. These are just to avoid the real encounter of two persons. People don't look into each other's eyes. They don't hold hands. They don't try to feel each other's energy. They don't allow each other to pour. Very afraid, somehow just managing, cold and dead in a straight jacket.
Ho, ho, ho. I'm making copies of those pages. I'm yeah. seriously am. Because no, it's not necessarily for me. Of course, here I am being judgmental, but I see other people in that.
I love that.
I know. How about that?
I just want to control somebody with this information. Exactly. Please allow this into yourself because this could help you. Please.
It is. Well, I was thinking about that when you were reading Ronnie, and then he did talk about that control actually is a very fear-based experience, because if you really weren't afraid, you would just kind of let go and let things happen. And when you're afraid, you're afraid of the outcome, then you have to be in control. So I think it's really very much related to fear.
You know, I would challenge Osho in one area. It's like controlled persons are always nervous. I believe that's true, but I also believe that there are people that are uncontrolled and they are just as nervous too, trying to act a part that isn't true to them either, you know? So, you know, there's always a spectrum. It's like, where do we fit on it?
Right.
And then the opposite end of the spectrum exists also and can be just as dangerous.
Well, yeah, isn't that the case with everything?
And isn't that what Osho Zen is all about?
It is indeed.
Oh, but to have no expectations for the future, I mean, you could be a fatalist, though.
Right.
And say, well, why even give birth? Why even, what difference does it make? Why do we hold beans in our body for 9 months? What difference does it make?
It's our experience, and I am a fatalist in many, many ways. And referring back to that movie Frequency, that's the bottom line, is we really, it's the matrix. The matrix is what the control center is, and we just play into it, and we think we have control when we don't.
Yeah, you know, that's true. But I, you know, having worked with people and knowing myself so well, I can tell you that I do believe there's parts of this that are true. To control the mind, one has to remain so cold and frozen. I mean, you are separate from the world.
Right. That's true.
You don't exist in the world because the world is scary and vulnerable. And so we have to have this surface image of ourselves like, ooh, I'm all in charge. I can handle it. And, you know, what if we actually said, I can't handle this?
I say that quite frequently.
Do you let go, though?
Yeah, a lot of times I do. Not always, but a lot of times I do. Yeah.
Thank you for your honesty. Because, you know, I can have an ideal thought, but it doesn't mean that my body's corresponding and ready to just follow through with the, oh, let's let go. Let's be at peace. Ooh.
Mm-hmm,
I don't know that word peace. I feel like, you know what, that maybe that's the end of it. You know, you can feel in peace or in pieces.
Ah, that's brilliant, Ronnie. Oh, you could write a book, Peace or Pieces. Ooh.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go,
huh?
Oh, and it would be about control, about what Osho has to say there.
But, you know, let's go back to that rhetorical question. You know, when you meet somebody, it's like, hey, how are you doing? And you really don't want to know. You know, the person that actually stops and says, oh, you know, this week's been really hard. And you're like looking at your watch going, man, I just really meant to say fine, good, thanks,
mm-hmm.
bye.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. just being, I like what they said, nobody means anything.
Yeah.
When do you get into those real conversations?
Right.
And it's hard because I think sometimes even in our family, we get into those surface relationships and, you know, they just don't soothe my soul. They don't connect me to anything. I don't know who you are if all I get is the surface.
Right.
I have a glimpse.
Are you willing to let people go deep with you?
Oh, yeah. It's a turmoil. It's a sea of raging emotions. I don't know. You know, most people back away very slowly and say, I've just encountered a snake. I think I should be careful around this area.
Sometimes when I think of myself and so when I'm in the course of maybe some drama, like I've just been dealing with my mother's dementia, and I just see myself like at the La Brea tar pits with that thick, gooey tar bubbling up and trying to break the surface, but it's so hard. And is that what control is? We're trying to break the surface. We're trying to burst through that thick, gooey tar, and it's going to pop on its own will?
Well, you know, the thing is that sometimes when we're controlling something, we're just trying to deal with our, like Osho says, our anxiety. It's like, I want you to feel better so I don't have to feel all this anxiety. I really need you to feel better because
it makes
when
me
you're
feel
not.
Better. Yeah. And that's the truth.
Yeah.
That is the truth. Because when I was able to speak with my mother on the phone on Sunday, which is miraculous because she hasn't been able to carry on a conversation, and she was lucid and she was making sense. And I'm like, oh, I was so happy. I was almost giddy because mm-hmm. she was better.
For a moment,
yeah. I'm hoping.
And we just have to enjoy those moments.
Yeah, that's so true. It is so true.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part, is just allowing those moments to exist and knowing that they are just moments and that there's so many other moments to this world. And that's penetrating the surface, isn't it? Getting beyond.
Yeah.
I do like that line, though. It's like, nothing can penetrate. World is ordered and perfect, but is not alive. And then, cannot touch others. How do people see and yet not see them? People live. There's just something about that.
Well, it is something worth thinking about. For those who are listening and follow along on the Osho Zen cards, the control is the king of clouds. And it does show a rather squared-in ruler in a very, it looks like a stainless steel throne. He's kind
feels
of...
like a refrigerator.
Yeah. Very rigid. There's no flow to it. There's no soft corners. They're all very sharp corners.
I just had this image of the refrigerators now, the stainless steel, that they don't allow any fingerprints. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
You know how we don't want fingerprints to penetrate even. It's like, please don't touch me. And if you do, I don't want any history of that.
Oh, that's true. Huh?
You know, think about what we've become in this world. You know, a car that doesn't dent. It's like, there's been no experience here. Let's just move through the world. I feel like a Jedi right now. No, you don't need to see my ID. Let me move through without actually seeing me.
Oh, little Padawan. Okay.
But it says, let's see here. It's as if he's almost mummified inside the structure he's built up around himself. And, you know, I can think of myself and I can think of other people, too, that... You know, when we're in control, we are mummified.
Mm-hmm.
There's
That's
nothing
true.
Moving. We're bound by this belief.
This is a very, very good and very, very insightful card that, they all are. Actually, yeah. Every one we have discussed of Osho's are very, very thought-provoking, if we take the time to ponder them. This one, for me, I have to spend more time on because it really resonates with me on several levels.
Yeah, and I like it that, you know, clouds, mastery of mind. And really, when we're controlling, aren't we being
right
or trying to master the mind? And really, I guess the true gift would be to master the mind is to allow and to accept rather than to control and restrict.
Well said. Now, think in terms of like the ant queen or the bee queen. Is she really controlling or is she just there... Their touchstone, because I don't see her, of what I've learned about ants or bees in the hive, she's not telling them what to do.
But she does control whether they live or not.
Yeah,
if she dies, they all die.
That's true.
So that's
because she's their
to
touchstone.
Her.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
And that's interesting. Hmm. But, you know, there is a flow. I mean, I've seen a queen bee come out of the hive and she does this little dance and they're uh-huh. all kind of dancing with them. And you know that's a language unto themselves that means something.
That is true.
But to us looking, it's like, hey, there's a flow here. It isn't so rigid.
Right.
It isn't like the queen is up on this throne so far away from the masses.
Right.
But she is protected.
Yes, she is. And that's significant, too, because without her, they can't exist, even though... I don't know that I would use the word control in that situation. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, you know, I think what's interesting is our topic today, suicide, making mm-hmm. peace with suicide. And you think about control, it's like there is this thought that, and I'm going to be lost on this topic in some ways, but, you know, the act of suicide, that is the last control where nothing else can be hidden anymore. And mm-hmm. you don't have any more anxiety over what the future holds. You know that there is no more anxiety or pain that's going to be experienced, although what's left behind.
Right. And I think it carries many facets. And she does talk about that in the book. But it's also somewhat of a manipulative gesture, too. There's those that I'm going to show you.
Yeah.
I had a, well, I'll talk about this when we do the interview. I had a nephew that attempted suicide and is in a wheelchair for the rest of his life.
Well, and I'm looking forward to this conversation because I think there's a lot of facets, and even nowadays with the social media and bullying and just the statistics themselves of, you know, what are the major factors involved?
Exactly.
Emotions and also veterans, teenagers. Yeah.
PTSD, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So.
Well, with that, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with our guest for today, Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell, Making Peace with Suicide. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. The Broad Perspective welcomes Joseph Doloshal. He is the founder and owner of the Pyramid Center in the San Bernardino Mountains. Tell us a little bit about the Pyramid Center, Joe.
Well, Vivian, the Pyramid Center was a concept that I started back in 2006, and the whole idea of the Pyramid Center was for people to come and explore their consciousness or their conscious being without essentially any ideologies or dogmatic ideas being in foistered upon them. And so it was just a place basically for inspiration, so seekers of any caliber or any developed grade can just come there, enjoy themselves, explore themselves. They can hang out, meditate, relax, read a book. They can also study any type of yoga that they want. And it is really just a general place for inspiration. And I suggest anybody who wants to know more about it, check it out online. And it's thepyramidcenter.org. That's thepyramidcenter.org.
Very good. Thanks, Joe, so much. Welcome back to The Broad Perspective on The Broad Perspective Network. I'm Vivian Camori.
I'm Ronnie DiGiovanni.
And our guest for today is Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell, author of the book Making Peace with Suicide, a book of hope, understanding, and comfort. And you know, it is all of that, Dr. Adele. It is very, I don't know how to say it. It is very smooth. It is very comforting. Even though I have not personally had this experience, although I did have a nephew who attempted suicide and has ruined his life, he's in a wheelchair from that experience. But it's definitely something that I think touches a lot.
It's thought provoking too, because it brings up a lot of questions for me and just also helps understanding.
It does. Yeah. It does. And you know what I was thinking, Adele, as I was reading this, is that this is definitely a niche that needs to be dealt with. Because it's not something that if you were going through this, I doubt that there are too many resources out there to help you.
Yeah.
Well, I know that there are a lot of books that mine's a little bit different, and that we talk. It's not the clinical conversation. Mm-hmm. It's the heart to heart. We're all in this together conversation.
Right. Right. I get that. And go ahead, Ronnie.
Oh, no, I was just, you know, when I first read the title, I was like, ooh, is this an allowance for the act of suicide? And I do have a question. If a person is not committing suicide, what is it? Because I was provoked by that statement that, you know, if you had to rewrite a certain part, you would say that you'd avoid using the term committed suicide.
Ah.
And I was really provoked by that.
Well, yeah, and I'll tell you why. You guys, there's an echo, so I'm hearing my voice come back to me as we're talking, okay? I just want to tell you that.
Okay.
So I feel like I sound funny. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when I first started, I'm going to answer that in two parts for you, Ronnie. When I first came up with the title, and people were like, oh, my God, you're condoning suicide. And I'm like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we need to make peace with it. And I do believe that people have choice, but I also believe that suicide happens for a myriad of reasons, a confluence of stressors, but it is the pain that takes people there. It is the absolute pain. Now, Oh, my gosh. I forgot the second part of the question. I'm doing really well here.
Committed suicide.
The committed, right. Well, because the committed is that suicide used to be illegal, right? And so for many people who have either been on the brink themselves or lost someone, they find this language highly insensitive. So I will not use that word anymore, saying someone committed. Because in the olden days, if you took your life by suicide, they would take your property. You couldn't be buried in sacred ground. Many times the family was ostracized. And there are still parts of the world where the family is ostracized if you take your life by suicide.
So the word commit is like committing a crime.
Oh. Yes, exactly.
You know, it's funny, a little light bulb went off when you were talking about that, because I know that what you just said to be true, but it wasn't part of my current consciousness. And I have an acquaintance who just lost a friend's wife to suicide, and he was asked to speak at the funeral, and he was very condemning of her at the funeral.
Oh, of course, and it's not awful, because there is such shame and taboo for the survivors of suicide, someone who has lost someone, or even they are. I tell the story in the book of a woman. Her husband comes home, pulls the gun out of the nightstand, faces her with a gun pointing at her, and says, "I'm going to kill you."
Right.
And she says, "No, you're not." And he says, "What do you mean?" And she says, "You like my mother too much. You're not going to do this." He said, "You're right." And then he took his own life. And she was 4 or 5 months pregnant with their son at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And at the funeral, the husband's friends came up to the wife and said, "What did you do to him?" That's what they said.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, the whole family.
And they were unaware of his mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
It was not something he shared with his friends. But family members and even the survivor feels guilty. What could I have done? Didn't you love me enough? I thought I was there for you. All those kinds of things. And survivors of suicide are automatically in a subset of high-risk suicide people because, one, the taboo has been broken.
Right.
Two, it is complicated grief. It's not your grandmother who is up 100 and lived a full life and said, "Honey, I'm ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a good life." It's messy, usually sudden. There's a lot of guilt, shame, and taboo. Code words like you'll read in OPIT. I didn't know this until years ago. Someone said to me, "Oh, Adele, so-and-so died suddenly." I said, "Oh, what happened?" Died suddenly was the code for taking their life by suicide. Another woman I've been working with, her husband died by suicide. And in the paper, he died at home. True, but died at home was accurate. But it gives it a different slant because nobody likes to say suicide. They don't like to talk about it. I interviewed a young man a number of years ago when I was doing the book, grew up in the Boston area, big Irish Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Tell me what happened." And his dad had severe mental illness.
Yeah.
And I said, "Tell me what happened." I said, "I assume you had the Catholic. And how was the church for you?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, "The priest was amazing because he talked about my dad's mental illness like being a physical illness." And this was 20 years ago, and that was really stepping outside of the box.
Mm-hmm.
Another woman in Canada told me that, you know, the neighbors were condemning her. How could you have the funeral in this church?
Right. One of the things I wanted to do, Adele, is bring it back to the story about the woman whose husband turned the gun on himself, and she was pregnant, and she gave birth to a son, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
And the son grew up and also had
mental health
issues. And if I remember correctly, even a leaning, there was a leaning towards a suicide experience. And so that led me to the question, and for our listeners, is this a hereditary genetic thing?
Oh, well, I have a happy ending to this particular story.
Uh-huh.
As you remember, when the young man was 18,
mm-hmm.
The psychiatrist said to his mother, "It is now time to tell your son the truth of how his father died."
Oh, that's
died,
right. Yeah,
right.
She hadn't done that till then.
And he then said, "Mom, I'm never going to do that to you." And he has been in touch with me since this book came out.
Uh-huh.
And this young man has some
biochemical issues. His father had some bipolar stuff. I don't know if the young man has an actual diagnosis, but I know that he's gotten some mental health help. Uh-huh. And the wonderful thing is he has now become a suicide prevention advocate and has led all sorts of awareness events on the college campus where he is now. He has taken this experience and he has changed things. But to your question, is there a genetic component? With depression, clearly we see that. If there's been suicide in a family, you know, in psychology we talk about nature or nurture. Mm-hmm. And nature is your genetic makeup, and nurture is the environment in which you're brought up, you know. And so it's usually a little bit of both. But if you have a diagnosis of bipolar, which used to be called manic depression, and there are varying degrees of bipolar, it speaks to a biochemical imbalance that there is a genetic factor.
Adele, we got right into this book, and we forget, we're going to take it back a little bit and just ask you for what, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and what made you interested in the subject, and, you know, let's bring it back home so we can go forward in our journey.
You're a mind reader, Ronnie. I was thinking that same thing, man. We jumped the gun.
I know. We're just like, we're the topic. Let's get into it. But it's like, wait a minute. Let's talk about you a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you guys are adorable. Okay, so... like you, Ronnie, I'm a psychologist. I've been in practice doing psychotherapy over 30 years. I've worked on suicide, domestic violence, sexual assault hotlines, and I seem to gravitate towards crisis and helping people get through crisis. And the book came about because a colleague of mine, actually in California, I used to go to a healing conference in California every couple of years, and we became friendly. And I got a phone call from some of the other ladies at the conference, and I'll call her Susan, and they said, Adele, Susan died. I said, what do you mean Susan died? I sent her an email for her 65th birthday and blah, 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 and I knew this, that, and the other. And then they were all hesitating, and I said, what's going on? And then they said, well, we think, or maybe, or whatever. Now, if you're open to the expanded perspective, while I'm having the conversation with them, Susan comes to me on my inner screen, and she waves at me, and she tells me she's okay, and she did, in fact, die by suicide. And later in the book, she gives me more information to give me an expanded perspective about suicide, which I found very, very helpful. But then I realized, I'm doing the dishes at the, I wrote an article because I was like, how do I make sense of this? And it's in the book, it's called A Psychologist's Suicide. And then I'm at the kitchen sink and I'm doing dishes, and you know that little voice says to me, you need to write a book on suicide. I have to tell you, it never crossed my mind before that. But then I realized when I was writing it, every experience in my professional life, and I've done a lot of trauma work, and I've never worked with a childhood sexual abuse survivor who has not been suicidal. And between the trauma work, the addiction work, where there is a lot of overlap with trauma and suicide, and there's that. And then I realized my own mother had suicidal tendencies, and I was a kid and found her with her wrists all carved up. And I remember I asked her, I was in grade school, and I said, my mom was a bad alcoholic, and I said, what happened? You know, she had these huge scabs on her arm. She said, the doctor did it to me. I said, no doctor would do that to you. That's not true. So I guess the seed was planted, and there was another experience with my mother where I just sat up one morning because intuitively I knew something was going to happen. I didn't know what it was, and I woke up early and just sat and we kind of had a stare down for hours looking at one another. And so all of these things, so I start writing the book, and initially, you guys, it was tough. It was so tough. Mm-hmm. It was like crawling over broken glass and barbed wire, and then something happened, and I'll use the term grace. You guys started out with Osho, so I think you'll be fine with it. And I just got the bigger picture and thought, you know, the only response to suicide is compassion. It's also a societal issue. You know, do we teach our kids how to be appropriately angry? Mm-hmm. You know, if we all learned how to be angry in a healthy, anger's good. It says, hey, what about me? Yeah. We have to protect things. You know, mm-hmm. we have to learn how to manage it and express it properly. And support for people. You know, there's no need for hungry, homeless people. We need more. It's a social issue. It is a huge social issue. And the suicide by economic crisis across the globe. I mean, in Ireland, when they had a great, you know, the past few years, great, you know, because of the economy and whatever, mm-hmm.
the number spikes of the working men, the number spike like 50, 56% increase in suicide because the guys couldn't work. And the woman in Spain who they're pounding on her door and foreclosing on her place. Yeah. And she went off her balcony, but she became kind of an icon for them, and she changed the laws in Spain on all these crazy real estate deals akin to what we had here, so that women with children were protected and certain people were protected. And it is in India, the farmers. We've had students here in the U.S. so overwhelmed by their enormous student loans, mm-hmm. and not able to find a job, they feel hopeless and make a desperate act. Yeah.
Yeah, it's that way in a lot of Asian countries as well. There's a lot of societal pressure to perform to a certain level, and young people, if they don't feel like they measure up, take their own lives. But then again, that culture tends to look at it differently than ours. Go ahead.
It's true. Years ago, I had the great opportunity to spend a summer in Japan. Mm-hmm. And the convert, I mean, young families where the child did not get into the right,
right school.
We're talking, mm-hmm. right school. It was right then. It was like their destiny was marked for forever, mm-hmm. and the honor and what have you. There's a wonderful guy by the name of Dr. Edward Chick, and he's written great books on veterans and healing and what have you. He's in my book, and he's oh my God, he's a magnificent human being, and he talks about the soul and helping soldiers. And he and his wife take people back to Vietnam. They don't have to be Vietnam vets, mm-hmm. but they do healing journeys. Oh, and wow. He said to me, "Do you know, Adele? There's no more PTSD in Vietnam." And I said, mm-hmm. "What are you talking about?" And he said, "It's the culture. It's so different from here." Mm-hmm. After the first few years of Vietnam, everybody held the burden of the war. It was just not the soldiers. And because of the religious beliefs in terms of past lives and understanding and suffering and acting in compassion and being held by the community, their healing process was different than what our vets got here.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. There is definitely a cultural component. We have to take a break. We're going to come back and pick this right back up where we left off in just a moment. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with more of our visit with Dr. Adele McDowell.
The 12th Hour. A show literally about
everything.
A candid discussion between friends about their different perspectives on what they think may be going on.
Or what is not going on.
With so many different areas of information being given out, we attempt to put together the puzzle pieces to create the broad perspective of the whole picture.
Welcome back to The Broad Perspective on the Broad Perspective Network. I'm Vivian Camori.
I'm Ronnie DiGiovanni.
And we're continuing our discussion with Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell, who is author of the book Making Peace with Suicide, a book of hope, understanding, and comfort. And before we took our break, Adele, we were talking, you had mentioned Vietnam and how they don't have PTSD, and we talked about different cultures. And I do think different cultures definitely have a whole different perspective on this. It's not taboo in several cultures like it is in ours.
Yeah, that shame isn't.
I
wouldn't argue that, but there are also places in the world where suicide is still against the law. That mm-hmm. has not changed, and you find that. And there are things such as honor suicide. I mean, even if you look mm-hmm. At Paris, for who, whatever mm-hmm. the thinking was, it was I assume driven by a need to take an honorable act from a very strong belief system. Not one, of course, that we would align ourselves with, mm-hmm. but, that would be the drive, because suicide is, if I'm in a studio with you guys and I'm putting pillows over your face, mm-hmm. you guys are going to fight me because mm-hmm. our primal instinct is for life.
Right.
So for someone to get to that place,
to fight against every instinct for life. You know, we all have had parents who've dealt with health challenges, and they're like, I'm going to fight this disease, right? I'm going to make it through. I'm going to, whatever. That's kind of part of our makeup. And, to make the decision in terms of suicide, it's to overcome that. Now, granted, there are individuals whose neurotransmitters and biochemistry, and they've been in and out of psych hospitals and on very serious antipsychotic medication. That's a different category of individual. It's like the gentleman in the book who, the voices told him he needed to kill himself because he was the last living person on planet Earth.
Yeah.
In this way, he would see his family again. You know, we know that was not a rational thought.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about suicide's three common elements. I mean, I was really taken with disenfranchisement, but overall, could you talk about the three common elements to suicide?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know that. The three common elements are what I came up with, and the research will tell you that, you know, suicide happens for three reasons, mental illness, substance abuse, and then a combination of mental illness and substance abuse. I look at it a little bit differently, and I see pain as the first element. Any kind of pain, that whether it's physical, emotional, spiritual, mental, you know, I have a gentleman I'm working with right now who is in a terrible place, and his thinking is such that, you know, and his anxiety is such that, you know, trying to keep him contained so he doesn't do something dangerous, right? You have that kind of thing. And then there's the disconnection. So if you saw the movie American Sniper and the Bradley Cooper's character,
yes.
And he comes home after, what it was, his fourth tour of duty,
mm-hmm.
and he's sitting in a bar,
mm-hmm.
and he calls his wife and he says, hey, I'm here. And she goes, why aren't you home? And he said, I needed a minute. And no matter if you have loved ones, if you feel disconnected and you don't feel like you're part of it, and you feel separate, that they're, you know, you're not part of it. And then that's another way. And you look at it with the college kids who have been bullied because of their sexual choices, right? They feel disconnected because they're not part of a more homogenous group or homogenous thinking group. You know, we found with children who have been bullied, or and kids becoming, because they have big ears, or they have peanuts, or they're underweight or overweight, or what, or their face has a lip that does something different.
Mm-hmm.
And those differences, and when you feel disconnected. And then the third one is disenfranchisement. And disenfranchisement to me is the exponential disconnection of, you've got your nose pressed to the glass of the world, and you have no anchor. You have no tether. You feel like you have no meaning, no value, no worth. You know, sometimes if you've been in a funk and somebody says, hey, I need your help, and you go and you help them and you feel so good, you know, kind of got you out of your funk, and you feel good helping them. Well, this is much worse than that. This is just feeling like there's no way that you're connected. And we, you know, the best example probably would be the vets. You know, they come home.
Mm-hmm.
Their world is so different. They feel that people don't understand them. They generally only want to hang with other vets because they understand each other.
Mm-hmm.
But then they have their own torments of their experience. It's you don't feel a part of the world anymore, and it's very, very painful. So if you're homeless, if you're or shame, oh my God, the pain of shame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've been shamed and you feel like you don't fit in any place. So that's what I mean by those three elements of pain, disconnection, and disenfranchisement.
Yeah,
I get that. Go ahead, Ronnie.
Yeah, you know, I was touched by that. And then, you know, just, you know, there's another part that really touched me, too, is just about the soul loss. And, you know, that just, I think it's someplace that we can all resonate with. It's like the dark night of the soul, or there's a place, and I think Walt Whitman said this, that the world breaks everyone, but we're strongest in the broken places. But some people don't heal that way.
Yeah, I love that. And I think there's also a song by Leonard Cohen that speaks to that. And soul loss, you know, the indigenous cultures, other cultures in the world, wouldn't use our DSM or diagnostic criteria.
Yeah.
It would be soul loss, right?
Yeah.
It would be just total soul loss. So an Irish therapist tells me the story of during the Troubles in Ireland.
of how this gentleman who was on one side killed his neighbor who was on the other side. And then he was being interviewed, and he said, when I killed my neighbor, and only the Irish, I think, would be so frank about this and how they would speak and say, said, I felt my soul leave my body. And he later took his life because he couldn't operate that way. I would contend, ladies, that we live such rush, 24/7, hurry, 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 do this, do that. I'm right there with everybody else. You know, we run around, that we don't smell the roses. We don't take the time. You know, when people go to the Grand Canyon, you hear across the board that people stand there and everybody goes, oh, because they're struck by awe and wonder and beauty. And we don't feed our souls. We don't have time for the real connections. We don't, you know, I'm always amazed, and I'm in Connecticut, and there's a little park near my office. And sometimes the only voices I hear are European or other non-American voices, because when the weather is inclement, because there's something about a different mindset in different cultures of enjoying nature, being out in the world. I think Japan built some kind of temple out of trees, and I know another man built a church out of trees someplace in the world that was very well received. But we forget, whether it's Mother Nature or stopping to play or, you know, actually putting down our technology, and when we don't feed our souls and when we're rushing, we lose sight of who we are. We don't feel great. We're prone to depression. We're over-caffeinated. We're over-tired. We're over-cranky. And not that that necessarily leads to suicide, but when you chip away at yourself and you forget who you are, it feeds into what I call the energy of suicide on the planet. And the energy of suicide is being run around by fear, and we have a lot of fear on the globe right now. You know, it's not being in touch with ourselves, you know. But I would contend, if we're going to go higher consciousness here, that this energy of suicide is a clarion call for us to lift up our heads and say, who am I? What am I about? Understand we're all connected on this blue-green marble, and compassion for one another and working together is the only response. And I understand we have people we view as enemies and terrorists, and it's horribly frightening. And I can't give you a total good answer about that. I know that I'm sure you guys do. I pray for light. I believe that every little bit that we can do of goodness or kindness or just small things, it's not that we're adding them up, but I think eventually that tips the balance, you know, and it makes a difference. And that's how we help one another. And if someone is in pain, we insert ourselves. We try to expand their world so that they have other options. And sometimes just giving somebody, you know, here's the 800 number, you know, you have it if you need it, you know, somebody to talk to in the middle of the night if you don't have somebody else to talk to, or you can do this, or there's a support group, or hey, the church around the corner needs X. Vivian, you know this with the scheduling. I was in South Carolina with the Red Cross with the floods, and I want to tell you what I was struck by, the power of church community. It was the churches who were banging it out, helping everybody, and one dear man, you know, his cheeks are gone. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful state, but there's dire poverty in parts of it. And this one man, and he said, well, the pastor asked me to come help. And I said, well, okay. And I happen to have, the Red Cross often gives out Mickey Mouses, especially those of us in mental health. And I had a handful of Mickey Mouses. And here's this guy, and he said, could I have a Mickey? I said, aww, of course you can have a Mickey. And I just envisioned this man going home to his tiny place or a room someplace. I'm sure he didn't, you know, just a room someplace with a single bed. And he and Mickey would be taking a nap in the afternoon. Yeah. The little things that we can do to help one another make a huge difference.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And thank you for doing that, by the way, because I know that you did. We had an interview scheduled, and then the floods happened, and you were called out. You're a volunteer with Red Cross, right?
Right.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so you went to be of service, which I totally respect, and thank you for doing that. Yeah.
Oh, you know what? It helps me. it reminds me that we're all connected, and it makes me feel good.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry people had to go through that terribleness, but I will tell you, the power of community and the power of church, of people helping one another,
mm-hmm.
and even with Katrina, the people who had the least amount, you would be, and they would say, oh, no, make sure there's enough for everybody.
Right,
you know,
right.
It people are amazing. And I understand there's not everybody is every wonderfulness, and we're all driven by, you know,
mm-hmm.
our experiences and our wounds and what have
mm-hmm.
you, but there's a lot of good out there, and I think the planet could use all the good it could get right now.
I absolutely concur, and you said a lot of key words in this interview that I think are very important, compassion being the biggest one.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to kind of go back to, once again, the cultural issues, because in some there's an honor in some cultures for suicide, like the kamikaze pilots in Japan, especially in war
right.
times. And I know back in ancient Japan, they would commit harakiri if their samurai or their shogun would die, then they would disembowel themselves. I mean, oh my God, I can't imagine what a way to go. But there was honor in that.
Yeah, the same thing with the Roman soldiers if they lost
yes.
the battle. Then,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so we've come, well, our culture, I guess I should say, has come a long way from that. But I can't end this show without at least discussing this issue, because in California we just passed doctor-assisted suicide, the legality of being able to take your own life if you're terminally ill and a doctor can help you, like the Dr. Jack Kevorkian thing.
Right.
And that's a huge, and personally I'm all for that. And I know Robin Williams, as it turns out, he didn't just commit suicide because he was depressed, because he was diagnosed with that, form of dementia that was only going to progressively get worse.
Well, no, but also he had the Lewy's body dementia that Robin Williams had already impacted him. The man was driven with wild anxiety. I mean,
yes.
You can actually download his autopsy online. At one
mm-hmm.
point I found it, so
mm-hmm.
which is amazing. But, yeah, no, he was literally, the anxiety and what was going on was crazy-making for him.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's 2 years earlier, but he has
right.
that form of dementia
mm-hmm.
that certainly influenced him. And I'm with you in terms of the assisted suicide. And I tell the story in the book of a woman who asked me, she's in her 80s, says to me, Adele,
mm-hmm.
is there a pill? And I said, no, there's not a pill. And big discussion of why can't I, you know, handle
mm-hmm.
my life the way I want to handle it
right.
when
mm-hmm.
I get to that point. And I know people have very strong feelings one way or the other, but there was a woman in California who went to Oregon, right,
mm-hmm.
who had the fast-growing
mm-hmm.
glioblastoma,
uh-huh.
right?
Uh-huh.
And people didn't understand it, and it is there's such taint and shame and taboo and sense of failure around suicide, and I, you know, when people, we've got higher numbers now with white males, older white males, and
mm-hmm.
we're talking 80s.
Mm-hmm.
who have been divorced, widowed, or recently received a poor health diagnosis.
Right,
right.
right.
And they make that decision.
Go ahead. Well, no, because we have to take another break. Fabulous. Just go ahead and jump into the break. We'll come back and pick up this discussion in just a moment. We'll be back with more of our discussion with Dr. Adele. Stay tuned.
BPN. Join the awakening.
The Broad Perspective Network is a portal designed to reveal a new perspective and reality to those who wish to know the truth about the world we live in and our role in it.
BPN. See beyond the illusion.
Well, Welcome back to The Broad Perspective on The Broad Perspective Network. I'm Vivian Camori.
I'm Ronnie DiGiovanni.
And this is the last segment of our visit with Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell, author of the book Making Peace with Suicide, a book of hope, comfort, and understanding. And it's been very interesting, Adele. This is a subject that you're very well versed on, and we sure do appreciate your spending time with us and our listeners, for whom this might be an issue in any way, shape, or form. This is very valuable stuff. Adele, how can our listeners get your book?
Oh, easy. You can go on Amazon. You can go to, I have several websites. The first one is my name, Adele, A-D-E-L-E, Ryan, R-Y-A-N, McDowell, M-C-D-O-W-E-L-L.com, or makingpeacewithsuicide.com. And I even have a blog about making sense of our upside-down world that's called AdeleandThePenguin.com, and I write a lot. I have a Huffington Post blog in Canada, and most of my pieces there are on suicide as well. And there's one that has been really popular called Understanding Suicidal Grief, and it seems to have resonated with a lot of people.
Okay, very good.
And that's how you would find me.
Very good. Excellent.
Many ways.
Looks like you're findable.
Yes. That's right.
Yeah, well, we always like to get this in here because we get so involved in the conversation sometimes, and then when we're done, then we'll get an email or from our listeners, and they'll go, how do we get this book? You know, or
who is this person?
Yeah,
or how, more information.
Yeah, exactly. So I always try and lead off with it because it's so hard to insert later, or we forget, and we try not to do that anymore. We've learned the hard way on that. Okay, so, in this last little segment, I really feel like we need to continue to take this stigma away from this experience, because I don't think it's something that should be stigmatized in any way, shape, or form. I really don't. I just don't. That's
me. I'm with you.
I just don't think there should be any stigma at all attached to it.
It's hard because a person's pain...
Exactly.
And journey is so personal for us to put any type of judgment or stigmatism. I mean, that just, it doesn't allow the story to be told or the life to have lived.
Exactly.
Its fullness.
And then that's
and remember other times where if you were of an age or infirm, you would eat the poison berry and be on the ice floe, or
right.
you would be around the fire and given enough food, and everybody else would move on, knowing that you were at the mercy of the elements of the wildlife. I mean, there are other times where choices were made, but you're right, the taboo around it, and I think it goes from it being a sin. Now, I don't, this may be anecdotal, but this is what I read, that, I was brought up Catholic, so I had Catholic schools for a long time. So the Catholic Church, in its infinite wisdom, decided, and I love Pope Francis, oh my God, what a being of life he is. Anyway, the Catholic Church, way back when, during Sercum, life was so difficult then that many people were taking their lives by suicide.
Uh-huh.
So at that point, the church came in and said, suicide is a sin, and if you take your life by suicide, we'll seize all of your property. And so people weren't letting anybody know, right? You know,
uh-huh.
And it's also... In today's world, if you take your life by suicide, as I understand it, your insurance policy is voided out. So,
it depends on the company.
If I don't want my family to be left without, you know,
mm-hmm.
and
a lot of them, it's a two-year clause. A lot of them, you can commit suicide, but only if you've had the policy for 2 years. So it negates people running out and taking out a $200,000 policy. And then doing it the next day because it was an intentional thing. So if you've had it for 2 years, it depends on the company. Some of them just plain old have an out-and-out suicide clause, but many of them, it's just you have to have had the policy for more than 2 years.
And oh, okay. I didn't know that. Thanks for telling me that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, so if we're looking at the taboo and what do we erase the taboo? Well, we have understanding.
Mm-hmm.
We put some. What you ladies are allowing, the wonderful thing about your show is you're allowing us to put light on a very dark topic. Remember when domestic violence came out of the closet,
yes,
right?
Yes, you're right.
You know, when different things come out of the closet, so to speak,
well, so now let's let suicide come out of the closet, and that it does exist, it does happen. But here's the shocking thing. Okay, World Health Organization says on average around the globe there is one suicide every 40 seconds. Mm-hmm. The National Suicide Research Foundation, they're out of Ireland, they say that suicide attempts can be up to 20 times higher. So, and in the United States, we have a suicide every 13 point something minutes. All right. Wow. But the amount of people who attempt suicide, the amount of pain, right, of people thinking, oh, my God. And because suicide happens on a range, you know, you can, the range is, sometimes people will come into my office, right, and you know, one of the initial questions is, you know, are you homicidal? Do you want to kill somebody? Or are you feeling suicidal? Or sometimes they'll come in and they'll be talking, and I say, well, if the pod people came and took you away at night, would that be okay? And they go, yes. And not that they want to die by suicide, but they're so tired, so depleted, they'll feel they either have the resources or options or whatever it might be to take the next step, and they're just played out.
Right.
And if that whole played out thing becomes a chronic state, and you're not connected to anybody again, you're disconnected, and you become disenfranchised. You know, I talked to a woman the other day that I worked with many years ago, and we're trying to find options for her because she's in a bad place after a series of deaths in her family, health issues, money issues, you name it, housing issues, everything. And she goes, Bill, what difference does it make? You know, what difference? No one's going to miss me. And I'm like, yes, people will miss you. It's very hard, and the world can definitely be tough. So if we talk about it, if we teach our kids, you know, EQ, right? We need IQ, intelligence quotient, EQ, emotional quotient, and CQ, cultural quotient. We have to understand that we all don't think alike. We're not all the same. In essence, I think we're the same, but we have different belief systems that structure things differently. And educating ourselves and helping the young people and being a parent to the young people. You know, sometimes parents today want to be their kids' friends and not their parents. And maybe this is just the world I live in and what I see. But I don't, you know, sometimes parents don't want their kids to be mad at them. And I'm like, really? You know, or the kids get too much money. And I always say, you've got to follow that money trail because kids will get in trouble with too much money. It is not a good thing. I had a kid who, I said to him, I said, if you are drunk on a Saturday night, can you call your parents and they'll come pick you up? And he said no. So the next week, the next session, in the middle of the session, I hear the outside door of my office. Then I hear footsteps coming to the inside door, knock, knock, knock. And he says, oh, I forgot to tell you, my mom's coming. And his mom comes in and she said, did you tell him that if he were to call home drunk, it would be okay and we should pick him up? I said, I absolutely did. I said, because we want our kids alive and safe, and we don't want him behind a wheel. She said, well, he'll be drunk every weekend. I said, if he's drunk every weekend, we're having another conversation. That's a different conversation. But if he gets drunk and is not in a safe place, you want your kid to feel safe enough to come home, right? So it's teaching our kids how to be safe and talk about feelings. And if they're in a bad, especially the young people, it's the number two reason that we're losing teens and young adults is suicide. Number two reason. And they don't realize that there's another chapter. And, of course, we know their brains aren't fully formed until they're in their mid-20s anyway. But you know the intensity of being a young person has to happen now. And, gosh, you don't understand. And it's tough.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you have shed some really good light on lots and lots and lots of different scenarios in this book. So we want to encourage our readers to check it out. Go to Amazon. If this is an issue in your life or your family's life in any way, shape, or form, or someone you know, this book is actually very helpful. So check it out, Making Peace with Suicide, Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell. Adele, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful you chose to spend time with us. And remember, listeners, same time, same place next week. Join us. It's all perspective. Join us at Broaden Yours. Thank you for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show. To keep programs like this and other programs on the Broad Perspective Network, go to thebroadperspective.com and click the donate button. We truly appreciate your support.